Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And this seems to be heading in the right direction, so we'll make it the good martini. The jury is still out officially on what's going to happen here. But yesterday, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted 19-0 on a piece of legislation that will now go to the full Senate. And the president says if it gets to his desk, he will sign it. And it would give Congress a voice on the proposed nuclear accord with Iran. So that's good. The interesting part of this, though, is that it's not an up or down vote on the treaty, which would require two-thirds approval to get it done. Instead, Congress would be able to vote on an eventual end to sanctions, according to the New York Times, and then later take up the issue depending on whether Iran has met its own obligation. But now it takes two-thirds to stop the president from vetoing it and essentially doing whatever he wants. So it definitely reduces the power Congress has compared to an actual treaty. But compared to where the president was with Congress's role here just a few weeks ago, which was nothing, it seems to be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I was trying to think through here what Corker's strategy is, because at first glance, this really looks like a giant concession. As you noted, that you go from having requiring a two-thirds support for a treaty, which, by the way, despite what the president says, this looks like a treaty to me. I think most people would say, oh, it's a really important issue of foreign affecting all kinds of different aspects of foreign policy regarding another country and regarding a nuclear arms program. Why in the heck wouldn't this be considered a treaty and thus subject to ratification to the Senate? And the general approach of the administration is, well, because we don't want to, and you guys disagree with us, so we shouldn't have to do that. So what is Corker doing here? Well, first of all, he got this idea, this alternative idea that got out of the committee by a 19-0 vote. He basically has put it to something where even the most loyalist Democrat who totally adores Obama and totally trusts him to handle all this has to kind of say, all right, well, we should have some say, because otherwise we might as well vote to disband. There really shouldn't be a Congress because we have no role in the prospect of making a deal like this. And, by kicking it past June 30th, he's now reached a point where, okay, administration, you've got another couple of months. We are not, quote unquote, interfering with the negotiations. You got it. It seems like, based on what we've seen from Iran, Greg, would you say that they're all hunky-dory and warm and fuzzy and kumbaya and very agreeable to everything we put on the table?
Doesn't sound like it. Apparently, we're devilish and a bunch of liars.
Yeah, basically, in addition to continuing to chant death to America, everything we say they agreed to in the deal, they keep standing up and saying, no, we totally didn't agree with that. And in fact, you guys agreed to eliminate all sanctions immediately, and you can't inspect our nuclear sites, and, the Ayatollah keeps saying we're untrustworthy and we're duplicitous and all that kind of stuff. Basically, Bob Corker is making the safe bet. He's betting on the Iranians to continue to act like the Iranians, meaning that come end of June, they're not going to be singing a different tune. They're not going to be saying, oh, we actually agreed to all those things the president did. And by that point, I'm assuming Corker will say it's now reached a point where the administration can't say we've gotten them to agree to the most incredible inspections regime of all time. We are not going to have any leverage after this. And basically, he thinks there'll be enough Democrats who will vote against the president in that scenario. That is a gamble. But I think the suspicion, basically the Obama bet is that Iranians are going to act a lot nicer between now and June 30th. And I don't know how much I would want to stake on that if I were the president of the United States.
No, but the president definitely taking some steps on foreign policy issues that are not very popular. And it's almost like he's trolling Marco Rubio this week, because Marco Rubio has been very outspoken on why he thinks the Obama administration approach to Iran has been a disaster. And he certainly has minced few words when it comes to the emerging administration policy on Cuba, which took another step on Tuesday. And we transition to our bad martini. And the administration announced that its intention is to remove Cuba from the list of the State Department's list of terrorism sponsoring nations. Now, it goes through a 45-day waiting period. Congress can pass legislation to stop it, but again, it would take a two-thirds majority to override a presidential veto. So it looks like the president will probably get his way on this. The fascinating part here, Jim, is that you had tweets from folks like Ben Rhodes at the White House saying the reason we're taking them off the list of terrorism sponsoring nations is because they're not a terrorism sponsoring nation, which apparently is true because they stopped doing it 6 months ago.
look at the bright side. You know, if you bring up their most recent sponsoring act of terrorism, I'm sure Rhodes would say, dude, that was like 6 months ago. Here's the thing, and I think it was Ben Domenech who has a piece over the Daily Beast saying, look, what we see in the Cuba negotiations, you know, I'm making air quotes as I say negotiations, because there's really not much of a negotiation going on. We are giving Castro and the Cuban regime basically everything they want, and in exchange, Obama gets the, you know, the very nice summit appearance and, you know, this headlines of peace in our time or something like that. But we could have gotten more, and you'd think that taking them off the terrorism sponsor list would be a big deal, you know. Normalization of status of Guantanamo, extradition of fugitives, apologies even for the surpassed support of terrorism, justice or accountability for shooting down an American civilian aircraft in international airspace in 1996, more Cuban political prisoners, open up to the internet, social and political. There was a lot of stuff we could have asked in response for this, and we didn't ask for anything because that's it. Obama doesn't really seem to – I would say he doesn't understand negotiation, but we've seen him take a really hardline stance against, you know, congressional Republicans. So I think in a very strange way, he doesn't really want anything to change in Cuba. He doesn't feel it's our purpose to stand up for human rights abuse, you know, for human rights activists and the people who are being thrown into Cuban jails without a fair trial and things like that. It's just not what Obama was sent to do. The Democratic Party doesn't stand for human rights anymore. What's kind of interesting is just how much the rest of the party hasn't really been bothered by that. And I think ultimately we can look back at this and kind of conclude that ultimately this was all about posing for them. This was all about opportunism, and that they were – this was never really a driving issue for the Democratic Party. But ultimately, the, you know, this is bad for us and bad for America, but ultimately it's worse for the people who are, you know, suffering in Cuba's jails.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case. And as you pointed out, other than Bob Menendez, I can't think of a single Democrat who's really upset about the Obama administration policy on Cuba. So finding the two-thirds to roll this back seems unlikely, to say the least. But on to the crazy martini now. And there are so many crazy elements of the Hillary Clinton van tour. We talked about it yesterday, and we saw the reporters scurrying around trying to catch up to the van as the van tried to avoid them, and all this other stuff that happened at this community college in Iowa. We saw the softball questions, and it was just kind of a lackluster event. But Hillary Clinton was talking about her major priorities. She talked about how she's fought for women and families her entire career, but once she gets into office, there are a number of issues she's really passionate about tackling, and here's one of them.
We need to fix our dysfunctional political system and get unaccountable money out of it once and for all, even if that takes a constitutional amendment.
Now, Jim, long before the email scandal, there was the Clinton Foundation donor scandal, which, as it turned out, they were accepting money from foreign governments while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. And you talk about the amount of money she's raising for this campaign. So the hypocrisy meter is smoking right now.
For perspective, in 2012, Barack Obama, the biggest spending campaign of all time, you take his campaign, throw in his super PAC, throw in the various allied groups that are totally nonpartisan, but you just happen to run lots of attack ads against Mitt Romney. You add them all up, you got a little more than $1 billion. You add up everybody doing the same thing on Romney's side, I think it came in just under $1 billion. So about $2 billion is how much was spent by the two campaigns in 2012. According to the New York Times, quoting Hillary sources, and people were throwing a fit about this last night saying, well, Hillary didn't say it. It's only her sources, you know, whatever. but basically saying that the Hillary campaign plans to spend $2.5 billion. When that number gets leaked, will they do it? I don't know. That's obviously an enormous goal that, you know, either – I mean, I don't think inflation is good right now, Greg. But basically you're saying a 250% increase in the amount of money it takes to run a successful presidential campaign. Now, is some of that a boast? Is some of that a number designed to scare away potential rivals on both sides of the aisle and to basically say, look, if you take on the Clinton machine, we already know we fight dirty. We already know that we've got the media mostly in our pocket. We got unbelievable resources. You know, we are just going to outspend you, and we're going to, you know, dominate the airwaves from now until November 2016. There's an element of that, but there's really no scenario in which Hillary Clinton doesn't spend an enormous amount of money. And basically, look, one, this is one of the advantages she have. You spend your time giving, you know, $300,000 to pop speeches to places like Goldman Sachs. You make a lot of friends amongst a lot of rich people, and obviously she's going to have no problem in terms of fundraising. At this point, we really can make a point that there really isn't much of a difference between Hillary Clinton Incorporated and the Democratic Party. If you're a Democratic, you know, mover and shaker, campaign strategist, talking head, all that kind of stuff, you're already on Hillary's payroll. or unofficially in the case of MSNBC. And so you have this you know, giant machine here, all fueled by money. She said her campaign is going to be about four things, and one of the four was campaign finance reform, Greg. Like, it's not just that, well, I got to take the typical hypocritical stance of a Democrat of denouncing money and then turning around and going to, you know, high dollar, you know, fundraisers, you know, 10 grand a plate and beyond. She also has to say, this is one of my top priorities. And oh, by the way, I'm going to raise $2.5 billion. but, you know, for what it's worth, she also said, like, the money, the Clintons have a very complicated relationship with money, or odd relationship with money. And it looks odder to those of us who don't make as much money as they do, which is just about all of us, other than, like, maybe Sheldon Adelson. and you know, because they make unbelievable amounts of money. She was still giving paid speeches a few weeks ago, right? I mean, their net worth is close to $200 million. I think that allegedly rich guy, Mitt Romney, wasn't his net worth something like $100 million? It'd be really interesting to compare. I guess the Koch brothers are billionaires, but basically they're in the high multimillionaire category, but not quite billionaire category. And you know, obviously she's going to be lunch pail Hillary, right? She's driving around in the Scooby van. She's just like us. She eats at Chipotle. This rather ludicrous pose of being ordinary middle class, not the multimillionaire that she is. And she'll, you know, she's denouncing the hedge fund managers' tax rates and high CEO pay. Because I guess those CEOs, who, by the way, you know, the average CEO, the median, I should say, is in the neighborhood of about $600,000. That's a lot of money to you and me, but like to, you know, when you've made a $14 million book advance to like Hillary Clinton has, that's jump change. That's two speeches for her. That's like three speeches for, or maybe even less than that, than Bill Clinton. And the idea they're going to run around saying, "Oh, those guys over there are making too much money," is just, I have this long rant in the Morning Jolt observing about how like Democrats talk about this because they don't want to talk about more important stuff. And thus, you know, she's utterly convinced that campaign finance reform is one of the biggest problems, one of the four biggest problems facing the country when, you know, the world is on fire, you know, families are breaking down, economy is still hobbling along, et cetera, et cetera. It's a thoroughly topsy-turvy world that she's, you know, that she's living in and trying to persuade the rest of the country we ought to live in too.
Well, she obviously hates Citizens United, and that case was predicated on a film that was anti-Hillary back in the 2008 campaign. So basically, her whole point is here that I can do whatever I want to tout my candidacy, but how dare you criticize me along the way?
I suppose so, right? I mean, you know, ultimately, most efforts to protect big, you know, spending money or limit the amount of money that it can be spent to you know, defeat a candidate or elect a candidate, ultimately, it's incumbent protection. And you know, if we are tired of these bums in Washington, then you have to allow people to pool their money and spend money to get somebody out. Otherwise, you know, the incumbent is always going to have an even bigger advantage. But, you know, nobody ever seems to see it that way.
No. It's always the greedy rich people, which, of course, she isn't. She just has a lot of money. She's not a rich person. Jim, we'll have to leave it there for today. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.